Hi everyone, welcome back to the Public Interest Environmental Law podcast brought to you by Peel UK. We hope you enjoyed last episode, and today we're delighted to have Niall Toru with us. We are your hosts, Jocelyn
and Steffi
and Rosrin.
Niall, would you like to go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got where you are now?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. My name is Niall. I am a solicitor at Friends of the Earth. I've been a solicitor for just over 10 years. The first seven of those were in the public sector, where I specialised in environmental law. But the last three have been at Friends of the Earth, where I've specialised in climate law and especially litigating climate change issues in the court.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. And in a few words, would you be able to introduce Friends of the Earth to our listeners?
We are a grassroots community that does environmental campaigning. We are international, so we've got groups in over 70 countries. Our particular group covers England, Wales and Northern Ireland, where we have hundreds of local groups run by thousands of volunteers who work really hard to bring people together in their areas to help protect nature and the environment. And we also have specialists who bring court cases, but also who seek to influence legislation in Parliament and other related things.
Thank you so much. I understand you have a specialisation in climate law, so maybe we'll start with that. Of course, the UK is famous for its 2008 Climate Change Act. Could you tell us a little bit about the role Friends of the Earth maybe had in bringing it about and maybe the influence it's had around the world?
Sure. Okay. So it was, as you say, brought in 2008, and that followed a campaign called The Big Ask that was led by Friends of the Earth and supported by many in civil society, also some celebrities. I think Tom York from Radiohead is a good example. And what the demand was for legally enforceable climate targets, and that's what the Act delivered. In terms of its impact around the world, this was, I think, the first example of what's it's called a climate framework law, because it sets the framework for the whole economy to decarbonize. And it was the first example of that, but many other countries have their own versions into force since then.
I'm sure that most of our audience knows exactly what the Climate Change Act is about, but we also have some audience that are students that maybe haven't studied environmental law. So could you briefly introduce its main tenets?
Sure. Okay. It's a very important piece of law. As I say, it's a framework law. I think what people will be most familiar with is the 2050 target, which is our net zero target. And that is in the Climate Change Act. That target is the UK's contribution to the global goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So that's the UK's 2050 target is part of that global effort. And by 2050, we have to reach net zero. And that means that the UK as a whole can't emit more greenhouse gases than are being removed from the atmosphere, for example, through trees or other processes. That's what the net zero means. It isn't just that target in the year 2050. The Act also puts in, I guess, stepping stones to get us to 2050, and they're called carbon budgets. And what they are is mini targets along the way, and they will cover successive 5-year periods, and the most recent one to be set covers the mid-2030s, and they are targets along the way, each carbon budget being lower than the previous one, to take us down to net zero by 2050. They're the provisions about decarbonisation. Another very important part of the Act is how we adapt to climate change and the impacts of climate change, and it puts duties on government to assess risks and to address those risks. So, for example, flooding or overheating in our buildings, impacts on our transport network of the impacts of climate change. And then finally, the Act also sets up an expert body called the Climate Change Committee, who will monitor progress, assess government performance, suggest solutions, that type of thing.
That's a great overview. Thank you so much. When the Climate Change Act was passed on the 28th of October 2008, it played a central role in contributing to the UK's image as a leader on climate change at the time. Do you believe that the UK continues to be at the forefront of climate law and policy today?
I would question we were ever at the forefront. The Climate Change Act is important, but it's not enough by itself. Certainly in terms of talking a good game, we were at the forefront, but there were many deficiencies and they continue. If before looking at examples of bad law, bad policies, the context is really important. We are in an emergency. The house is on fire. The UN have said it's a code red for humanity. We need urgent radical action. It's also fair for normal people and doesn't leave them behind. The economy can be looked at like a supertanker that takes serious effort to turn around, and we're just not doing that. So that's the context. And within that context, I mentioned the Climate Change Committee assesses government progress earlier, and they did an assessment of the policies that need to deliver on that really important carbon budget for the mid-2030s. And they said that there are credible policies for only 19% of the cuts we need. So over 80% of the cuts we need don't have any credible policy. So we're certainly not at the forefront in that respect. That's the kind of overarching climate framework. There are lots of other examples of bad law and bad policy. A good place to start would be in the North Sea or under the North Sea, where the UK continues to look for new oil fields and new gas fields. And the science is really clear. You shouldn't be doing that to stay on path 1.5 degrees. But the UK is, and not only are we doing it, it's actually a legal duty to do it if it's possible to do so. It's called the Duty to Maximise Economic Recovery. It's in the Petroleum Act 1998, and it needs to be scrapped straight away. And then one final example, because there's lots of examples, but one final example of bad policy would be in town and country planning. So when a council decides a planning application, for example, for a coal mine, there's not really any proper policy there where the decision maker can look at this horrendous proposal for a coal mine in a climate emergency and assess it against these carbon budgets. It just isn't there. And it's not just me saying that. The Climate Change Committee have criticised government for that lack of joined up policy that's just letting really bad developments through the door.
Thank you. That makes me think of an issue that I see. Do you think that it's a problem of a legal framework, or do you think it's more of a problem of conjecture and current political situation? So do you think the problem is more in the provisions of the Act, for instance, or more what people are doing with them?
Well, I think both. I think there are certain laws that give the power to brave politicians to deliver the change that's needed. I think the Climate Change Act gives powers in that respect. But then they're just not being used because we are where we are. So there are some examples where the law does give those openings. There are other examples. I mentioned this duty to max out recovery of oil and gas. I mean, that's very powerful. It was no doubt lobbied for by the fossil fuel industry, and they're reaping the profits from it because it's there in statute that it's ignore the climate crisis. If it's profitable to extract, then licenses should be granted. So I think there's a little bit of both there. And what you need from politicians is leadership, which is to both use their powers, and when there are legal obstacles, is to remove them.
We're going to discuss a little bit more later in the podcast about what a change in government would mean for climate and environmental policy and law in the UK, which I think will be very interesting. But I'd just like to ask you first about when in 2022, Friends of the Earth won a court case against the UK government over the government's net zero strategy alongside Client Earth and the Good Law Project. Could you tell us why the court decided to rule in your favour and what the impact of this ruling has been?
Sure. The net zero strategy was the government's policy package for delivering on the climate targets. It's the overall package of policies. It's about climate action. So you've got the targets on one hand, and then you've got the policies that should deliver on the cuts needed to meet the target. It came out in 2021 after the setting of the carbon budget I mentioned earlier. We saw it along with many others, and we just thought it was lacking some crucial information. And importantly for our case that we eventually took, it didn't give any kind of breakdown of the emissions cuts that were expected from the policies. And it's really important because the climate targets are just numbers. They are legal upper limits on total greenhouse gas emissions that the UK can have in any five-year period. So they're important numbers, but they are numbers. So when you see a policy package that should show us how we're going to meet those targets, you expect to see some kind of estimate of emissions reduction they'll deliver. There wasn't any there. So we were very concerned. We brought our legal challenge alongside Good Law Project and Client Earth. And as part of that legal challenge, challenge, we learned that it wasn't just us kept in the dark. It was also the minister who signed off on the strategy. He wasn't told this information. So we said, well, that's unlawful. How can a minister who's under a duty to consider whether these policies will enable the budgets to be met, how can he do that if he doesn't have this crucial information? And the court agreed, and they held it was a breach of the Climate Change Act. And then they also agreed with us there's a separate breach of the Act, because government didn't then go on to publish the information, put it before Parliament, and allow us, our MPs, expert bodies, everyone, just to see if this plan is fit for purpose. So yes, that they're the two main grounds that the court allowed the claims.
What would you say the impact of a favourable court judgment has been for you?
In that first challenge, well, the court sent the government back to the drawing board and told it to revise its overarching plan and come back with one that was lawful. And that's why we got the carbon budget delivery plan that was published last year. So that was one big impact. And we got that plan, and it did include the numbers that were missing in the first version, which was an improvement. It also included other information. Unfortunately, having seen that extra information that was hidden from us first time round, the Climate Change Committee said they were less confident these policies would deliver than they were first time around. So we had the increased transparency, but it actually showed us that the picture was worse than we thought it was. But that is a good example of judicial review, of court challenges, increasing transparency and holding politicians accountable.
You'd mentioned the government's carbon budget delivery plan. Could you just tell us a little bit about it, and in particular, how this plan differs from the net zero strategy?
Sure. So it is the second version of the group of policies that will get us to our carbon budgets. The first version was the net zero strategy. The second version, following the court case, was the carbon budget delivery plan. And it differed in legal terms because it had that information that wasn't there the first time around on emissions targets. But it also differed in, as I say, being a suite of policies that gave the government's experts less confidence that the cuts would be delivered. So yes, we were left in a, it was good that it was revised, but we were still left in an unsatisfactory situation.
I understand that that's what led you back to court in February of this year. Could you tell us a little bit more about grounds of this current case and what you're expecting from the High Court?
Yes, so we brought a fresh legal challenge, as you say, also alongside Client Earth and Good Law Project. And what we all argued was that this new plan also breached the Climate Change Act. It was quite similar in that it was missing key information. This time it wasn't about the numbers, it was about the high risk nature of the plan. And pausing there, the context is that the government's approach to climate change generally is to trust the market over government intervention. It's not to seek to change consumer behaviour, and it's also to trust in novel incoming technologies that we've been told are around the corner for years and decades and just haven't arrived. So that's quite a high risk approach. So you thought risk to delivery would be a central aspect of this new version of the plan. It wasn't. We were very concerned to see that, so we brought our second claim. And again, through the litigation process, we learned some pretty alarming things about how this policy was put together behind the scenes. It started quite well. So government departments were asked to rate each of their policies to say how confident they were in them being delivered. And they were told to use a traffic light system. So red is high risk, green is very confident. We were shown what happened in the environment department, and we assume that reflects what happens across government. And what happened in the environment department was nearly half of their policies, the officials there said that they had either low confidence or very low confidence in the policies actually being delivered in the real world. So red lights flashing up across government. And then the strange thing that happens then is the officials who are sort of coordinating all of this, they see all of these red lights, and then they decide that it wouldn't be helpful to present this to their minister. So they don't. So the minister never sees it when signing off on this new version. And what he's told instead, the minister, by his officials, for any of those policies where the confidence was low or very low, he's simply told that the delivery risk is, quote, uncertain, which we say is vague, and it hides the true risk of the high risk nature of the policy and puts the government in breach again of the Climate Change Act. Because again, if you're a minister signing off on this, how are you supposed to know if these plans will deliver if you're not told this crucial information? And we also say, again, like the first challenge, that this information should have been made public. So they're the two main elements of the challenges that were heard in February by the High Court, which is considering the arguments and is yet to issue its judgment. But we hope that court will agree with us and send the government back a second time to revise its plans so that they're lawful.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that. My next question is, judicial reviews, as you've mentioned, appear to be key for challenging environmental decisions at both the local and the national level. Could you explain to our audience, many of whom are law students, how judicial reviews work in practice?
Sure. Okay. So I think as students will be taught in law school, the main purpose of judicial reviews is to stop public bodies exceeding their powers, the legal powers that are granted to them by Parliament. There is a constitutional mechanism. How it works in practice, to bring firstly, all decisions by public bodies can generally be judicially reviewed with some minor exceptions. To bring a claim, you would need to have what's called standing. That means you have genuine interest in the outcome. You're not just a busybody, just interfering for the sake of it. You would bring your claim in the High Court. You would need the court's permission to go to a full trial. And to get that permission, you'd need to show your grounds are arguable. And that filter is there designed to weed out weak claims. So the types of grounds that you can bring. Really importantly, it's not about re-arguing the rights and wrongs of decision. To an extent, you have to sort of tuck it up if you don't like the way an elected body has decided something, unless you can show that it was somehow unlawful. So that's the basis of the grounds, some kind of illegality. And that can be quite narrow, quite frustrating for claimants to hear. But examples of the grounds you might bring, you might say that the decision maker acted rationally, or that the procedure they followed was unfair, or that they breached your human rights. It's those types of arguments that you would bring to the High Court. If you get to a hearing, the defendant would have a right to defend itself, and they often do. The High Court can either dismiss your claim or it can allow it. If it allows it, if you win, the court then has the power, or has various powers, but it can what's called quash the decision, and that effectively means striking it down. Not remaking it, but striking it down and sending it back to whoever it is, the council or the minister, whoever made the decision to decide again second time round. That can lead to a better outcome for the claimant if the decision maker changes their mind, or the decision maker could just say, thought about it, I've followed the legal process this time, I'm making the same decision. Again, that can be often be quite frustrating for claimants. The High Court's decision is not necessarily final. And the losing party can seek an onward appeal to the Court of Appeal or even the Supreme Court. Final point I'd make on this, really important for environmental judicial reviews, environmental court challenges, is to mention the Aarhus Convention, which is an international agreement under the United Nations that the UK has signed up to. It is designed to allow access for people to information about the environment from public bodies. It should enable them to participate in decisions and impacting them, like planning applications. And it also, the Aarhus Convention also guarantees a right to access to justice. So that would include these types of legal challenges. And one result of this convention is you have, it's really important for claimants bringing these claims, is you can often get caps on your exposure to the other side's legal costs. The UK isn't complying with its duties under the Aarhus Convention. And we and others in the environmental movement have challenged that before the United Nations. That's important to note, but it has at least resulted in these protections in the civil procedure rules.
Thank you. That's quite helpful, I'm sure, for many people. How do you feel the High Court has been receiving cases and environmental cases? And do you think there's been an evolution as science progresses and public awareness is raised?
That's an interesting question. I think I am on the claimant side of things, so that's my perspective. I think there has been an increase in certainly sort of climate cases over the last year, over the last 5 years in the UK and globally. That has definitely resulted in judges who may not have had a background in this area to really get to grips with what can be quite technical areas, and some of them have, some of them haven't. I think it's a process that continues. It's, I'd say, mixed. I think there are some positive judgments. One that I would point to is a case that Friends of the Earth brought against UK Export Finance in the High Court. The decision of Justice Thornton was, I think, very enlightened and reflected current consensus on climate science. Unfortunately, that case was failed in the Court of Appeal, and many cases do flounder, but some succeed.
Thank you so much. That's really interesting. Very much related to this and to judicial reviews is a sort of follow-up question. Do you have any recommendations for listeners seeking to protect biodiversity and the environment in their local area? And what is the process for challenging development decisions that are likely to have an adverse impact on the climate and on the natural environment?
Yes, so the recommendation I would say is join a local Friends of the Earth group. If there isn't one, set one up in your area or something similar. There is always power in collective action. There's huge consensus that we need radical action, and we are stronger in demanding that action when we speak with one voice, especially as politicians tend to be swayed by business as usual vested interests. So I think that's one thing, act collectively and build power from the grassroots up. In terms of the process for challenging a development decision that might have a bad impact, I think participate in the decision-making process. They should be, I mean, one example would be a council considering a planning application. These processes should be designed for anybody impacted to have their voice heard, whether they've got expertise or knowledge of the process or not. And it often isn't as daunting as you think it might be. And the more people who care about these things that actually get involved in them, the better informed the decisions will be. If the decision goes against you, look to see if there are any rights to appeal. Sometimes in some processes there are. If there aren't, then often you're left with quite stark choice about whether you bring a claim for judicial review, and you'd be wise to get legal advice before taking that big step.
Thank you. And speaking about kind of the political power involved in climate decisions, general elections are obviously coming up this year. Do you have three questions that you say we should be asking our candidates, both in terms of nature and climate?
I've actually got 10. I won't go through them all, but the reason I say I've got 10 is because Friends of the Earth has published 10 demands for the general election. It's on our website if you search for that. And the background to that, we did this at the last election, is we put these demands out when the manifestos are being drawn up. We look at the manifestos when they come out and we score them and their performance against our demands. And we'll rank the parties according to those scores. So there are 10 demands on our website. I'd encourage listeners to look at all of them. I'll pick some examples. They're grouped into categories, and there's three categories. So I'll choose one from each one. So the first category is the climate and energy crises. And the demand there relates to fixing our heat-leaking homes, which are, most heat-leaking in the whole of Western Europe. We have the oldest and draftiest building stock. The second category of demands is having a healthy and nature-rich environment. And the demand there is to introduce into domestic UK law a human right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment, which you see in other jurisdictions. And so Friends of the Earth is part of a wider campaign to introduce such a bill into Parliament. And the bill is there, it's ready. And it links back to this Aarhus Convention I mentioned earlier, this international agreement, and we want that strengthened, a little bit like the Human Rights Act strengthened the European Convention, and we want it in domestic law so it can be relied on more easily by claimants. So that's the second demand. And then the third category of demands is to protect and enhance our democracy. And one of the demands there is to reverse the restrictions on protests, which have been absolutely draconian. They constrain people's civil liberties that have been in place for centuries and are a vital part of our democracy. And they're hugely concerning and chilling, and they are shrinking a space for any legitimate protest by people who have genuine, deep felt concerns about the direction our politics is heading. So they are sort of three of our demands, but do look at our website for the full list. They, what we say is what anybody should be demanding of the main political parties in the run up to the election.
Fantastic. That was a really great overview. And I'm really looking forward to checking out the rest of the demands on the website. If there is a change in government at the next election, what implications do you think that this will have for the UK's agenda on the environment and on climate?
We are not party political. So anybody who holds power, we'll hold them accountable and we'll criticise them where we need to. I would see this upcoming election as a huge opportunity if you're brave as a politician. So renewable energy means cheaper heat, cleaner air, more jobs. Low carbon buildings means warmer homes. Sustainable industry means more exports, more jobs. These are huge opportunities for politicians, and other countries are doing this. Even the US with its Inflation Reduction Act is pumping billions into this. So I don't have a crystal ball. We haven't seen any of the manifestos yet. We'll score them when they come out. So at this stage, all I would say is this is a huge, huge opportunity, and it could be a game changer if the politicians are brave enough to grasp them.
Thank you. And for those of us that have local elections coming up, do you have any advice on what we should be focusing on as far as local councils are concerned?
Yes, again, I'd say join a Friends of the Earth group or something similar. Meet your candidates, let them know you care, ask some difficult questions, try to secure meaningful commitments. And when they do that, sort of tie it in, get them to say it on social media. This is the time where you can really have that impact. By engaging with the process, and you can hold them accountable if they then get in. In terms of what you might ask for, we've got, as I understand it, we've got elections for mayors and elections for councils. We have pledge for mayors on our website. We're asking those who want to be mayors to sign up to. And it's designed to sort of show that they commit to ambitious, urgent, meaningful action on climate and nature. For the council elections, it's a bit different. It's a bit more about local context, but you could ask for a climate action plan to be put in place, or if there's one already, to make it stronger. You could ask for more cycleways. You could ask them to oppose if there is a particularly climate wrecking project in the pipeline in that area, like oil extraction or coal mine. You can ask them to oppose that on climate grounds. You can ask councils if they are putting their money, for example, their pensions pot, into the fossil fuel industry as an investment. You can ask them to take it out, to divest fossil fuels. You can ask them to play a part in addressing the cost of living crisis, and that might mean doing more to insulate homes, especially for those most at need. You could ask them to plan their cities and towns in a way that reduces the need to rely on cars. There's all sorts of things, and a lot of the delivery of what's needed has to happen through local level. And now is the time before the elections is a ripe opportunity to be making your voice heard on these things.
Brilliant. Increasingly, I think local councils are declaring climate emergencies and biodiversity emergencies. Do you think that this is an effective tool to create change at the local level? And do you think this is something that more constituents should be asking their councils to do?
I think they should be doing it. It's not enough by itself, but I think it demonstrates intention and the direction that the council wants to go to, as long as it's not greenwashing. So it's greenwashing if they declare the emergency but don't do anything, which sadly does happen. So it needs to be alongside sustained political action on delivering against against any targets, but recognizing there is an emergency is a good start.
Thank you. I'm kind of shifting back to our previous topic of discussion on litigation. I have a question that came to my mind, which regards the scientific evidence you use when you're bringing those cases. To what extent do you feel like science is a limiting factor at the moment in bringing judicial review claims and in Friends of the Earth's litigation strategy at the moment?
What do you mean by limiting? What did you have in mind?
So my question was, we've seen science being a limiting factor in private litigation, where establishing a causation link can be difficult to attribute a harm to a corporation. Are we seeing similar scientific challenges when bringing litigation against public authorities?
That's a very interesting question. I am not involved in the private action, types of private action you're referring to, but I am aware that causation is tricky sometimes. You've got lots of emitters, and how do you tie it down to any one particular company? That, you know, emissions have happened for a long, long time now, but there are methods being established to overcome that. In terms of the challenges to public bodies, so judicial review, which is the main type of challenge we bring, the science is very much part of the backdrop, but it's not as central as it is in some of those private challenges. We will sometimes have expert witnesses who will be scientists, and they might give expert reports, and their purpose is not to support our case. It's to help the court understand any technical issues that it needs to understand, to see if there's been any public law errors. evidence. Otherwise, it's really about the legality of the decision, and witnesses don't play such a central role. What tends to be important are the reasons for the decision, the process that was followed, how all of that was recorded in the papers that are disclosed by the decision maker. And so it is quite exceptional to need to bring an expert in, because the court can usually understand whether a decision maker has acted irrationally or whether an important consideration has been ignored. So yes, I would say probably less of a barrier than in the private cases that you're referring to.
And maybe just a quick follow-up. To what extent do you interact with the Climate Change Committee, and what do you support each other? And well, does the Climate Change Committee help you in your actions in any way? Maybe they work the producer.
Yeah, so they haven't intervened any of our claims. I think they, to my knowledge, they've only ever intervened once in a claim for judicial review. And that involved, I think it was back in 2019, where the UK was being criticised for not bringing the net zero target in following the Paris Agreement. And there was a challenge. And I think the Climate Change Act Committee did intervene. But otherwise, they haven't tended to go into the courtroom to do their thing. Do rely a lot on their reports. They're very clever people, and they're very good at doing things like modelling or analysing policies. I mentioned earlier their assessment of how credible government policies are, that type of thing. And they do this annually, and they do it under the Act. They have to do it annually. So all of these, I guess, outputs from the committee can be really important for claims, but they don't tend to be parties themselves. I would just add, whilst the committee hasn't involved itself, our most recent challenge, we talked about earlier, to the Carbon Budget Delivery Plan, there was a witness, Lord Deben. He was the chair of the Climate Change Committee until recently, and he put a witness statement in support of Friends of the Earth's case, and he's written about it online as well, I think the Politico website, about why he supported the case. So there is, we would say, that clearly does reflect concern by experts with the government's inaction, but it wasn't the committee itself involving itself.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. That's really, really interesting. We'll try to pop links to all the website pages that you've mentioned in the episode details so that the listeners can find them easily. We have a lot of students listening to this podcast. What would be your advice for those who want to pursue an impact-driven legal career at an NGO such as Friends of the Earth?
Well, I think it's probably best to start how we would recruit. We would look objectively at any application. We don't care what background people are from, whether they went to a prestigious university or not. It won't increase their chances. We're interested in what they can show in terms of being suitable for the role and showing a dedication to environmental protection and social justice. A good piece of advice I would say for law students looking to go in this direction will be to start looking at job adverts for the types of roles they might want to be in the future, which should have specifications. You should list out the things you'll be tested at when you go for the interview. And just look at them and think, well, if I were to do this interview tomorrow, where would I fall short? What experience do I need to build? And think about how you can do that. Also, don't let any stereotypes about what a lawyer looks like impact you. It really doesn't matter your social class, your ethnic background, your gender, sexuality, any of that. We need to be more inclusive as a profession. And hopefully at Friends of the Earth and Others, as an environmental movement, we're doing our best to change our recruitment processes so we are. So yeah. Best of luck to anybody looking to go in that direction.
And I think our final question, kind of on a similar topic, is I know I've been hearing quite a lot, I'm very interested in joining an NGO at some stage in my career, such as yours. And I think having an impact-driven career is something that's very important to me. One thing I've been hearing quite a lot is that I should train in private practice before joining an NGO such as Planet Earth or Friends of the Earth. Do you think that's a good idea, or would you recommend it or not? I think it's what you've done.
No, I can't speak from experience. I qualified in the public sector. But I have seen it is a common route for people to, I mean, it's hard to qualify, that's one thing. So there are limited opportunities for those coming out of law school, and you can go via private practice. There are many good law firms out there that do good public interest litigation. One example is Lee Day Solicitors. We work with them on a lot of our cases. But choose wisely, because not all law firms are equal in terms of whether they're greenwashing whether they're part of the problem or the solution. I would say it's not enough for a law firm that's raking in profits working for fossil fuel companies to put some solar panels on its offices and declare itself part of the answer. They're not. They're part of the problem. They've got freedom to choose who their clients are. The Law Society have put guidance out on this that gives them that freedom. And tomorrow they could decide not to take any new cases along those lines. So I would say choose wisely. If you want a good resource on this, then there are the scorecards put out by the Law Students for Climate Accountability that rank major firms on the transactional work they do, on the litigation work they do, and they give them a rating A, B, C, D, etc. And you can see which law firms really empowering the status quo and which ones are moving away from all of that. I would say that's very important when choosing where to go. But I wouldn't say that, you know, I think private sector can definitely be a route into all of this.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much, Niall, for coming on the podcast today. We've absolutely loved having you. It's been really interesting. And yeah, I feel like I've learned so much over the past 50 or so minutes. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was really, no, really very interesting.
Good questions.
Thank you. I hope you all enjoyed it. And I look forward to seeing you on the next podcast at PLUK.